So there we sit, safe and secure in the comfort of our living rooms. But in the pale fire of our television sets, things are not so safe and secure. On the Nature Channel, there are animals eating animals. And on the nightly news, there are people killing people. All this television carnage leads us to ask, which is most cruel, beasts or people?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 959th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in Elfin Cove who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I'm Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Aaron Shore on the boards. Hello, Aaron.
Good morning.
Aaron, got a question for you.
I may have an answer.
Okay, which is most cruel, man or beast?
Man.
Man. Well, also with us today, we have two brand new interns from the University of California, Kristen Carlson. Kristen, hello, welcome.
Good morning.
Now tell me, which is most cruel, man or beast?
Definitely man.
Definitely man. Also with us, Anna Ringerman. Anna, welcome.
Good morning.
Now, you tell us, which is most cruel, man or beast?
I would say man as well.
Man. There it is. It's getting to be pretty well unanimous around here. Well, folks, we sit transfixed as we sit right there in front of the television. Nature channels, pride of lions ambushes a zebra, kills it and eats it. Switching channels, we find ourselves shivering in terror as Shark Week fills the screen with giant great white sharks that turn blue water red in the feeding frenzy. Wow, we think those animals are really cruel, but they do have to survive. Then we switch to the evening news and watch as people blow each other up with bombs filled with nails. Wow, we think those people are really cruel. Do they have to do that to survive? All this televised carnage leads us to ask, what is the nature of man and beast in the wild out there? What is the nature of man and beast in civilization? And which is most cruel, man or beast? Here to help us hunt down an answer today, we have Jeffrey Wasayef Mason, who is the author of Beasts, What Animals Can Teach Us About Good and Evil. Jeffrey, welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Good to have you aboard. You're a Kiwi in America on a book tour.
That's correct.
Well, welcome to the United States of America. Love your country. Are you a North Islander or a South Islander?
I'm a North Islander, but actually I'm originally from Berkeley, California. I've been in New Zealand for 13 years, but I miss California, I have to tell you.
Okay, well, so there's an airplane to get you back and forth, right?
Right. Yes.
So, you know, I see where you are a former psychoanalyst, and that you have become an author of animal books, correct?
That's right.
Yeah. Some of your books include When Elephants Weep,
yes.
Dogs Never Lie About Love, and
yes.
This one is Beasts, What Animals Can Teach Us About the Origins of Good and Evil.
Yes.
So I have to ask you, why did you make this transition from treating
psychoanalysis, you mean?
Yeah, from treating people with mental problems to writing about animals that seemingly have no mental problems.
That's right. Well, I think I've written a lot about this. I wrote a book called Final Analysis and The Assault on Truth and Against Therapy, in which I stated my position that after having been an analyst, a Freudian analyst for a while, I found that there was something missing. And in that case, primarily, it was around the issue of child sexual abuse, because this was in the late 70s and early 80s when analysts were denying that there was such a thing. And I was the director of the Freud Archives and found many letters and lots of historical material in the archives which indicated that Freud knew, in fact, that abuse was real. And the reason he gave up that early belief was because he couldn't stand the heat he was getting from his colleagues, who did not want to be told that children are being sexually abused. And when I saw that my own colleagues in the analytic world refused to accept this new material, I left the field. But it's also true that I found it very difficult to understand human emotions. We have unconscious emotions. That is, we have feelings that we're not aware of. That puzzled me a great deal. I believe it's true, and it was one of Freud's great merits to draw attention to that. But it seemed to me, having lived with animals all my life, that animals did not share that. That animals did not have unconscious emotions. What an animal was feeling was obvious both to you and to the animal. And that intrigued me, and I decided I wanted to investigate animal emotions. And so I made that shift. I also got fired from the Freud.
That helped too, right?
Yes, it did.
So what you saw in people was this incredible complexity, made even more complex by situations that were being ignored by the people who are supposed to be studying this complexity.
Yes, indeed, yes.
And what you saw in animals was pretty much the opposite, an incredible simplicity with which it's the what was inside is displayed. What's outside, there it is, as plain as...
Yeah, I wouldn't call it simplicity. I would call it purity.
Uh-huh.
That is that their emotions were much more pure than ours. They were not mixed with the ambivalence we often find. I mean, you see that with your dog. You know, he looks up at you with sheer adoration, and it's not mixed with any kind of hatred or disgust or, God, I wish I were out of here. He's just looking at you, fully attentive to you.
Mm-hmm. Except when I'm teasing them, and then it's exasperation that I see.
But yet they can feel exasperated, but note that they don't get angry at you in turn.
That's correct, yeah.
Which is quite amazing, actually.
So when did you make that leap from people to animals?
Oh, it was a long time ago. My book, The Assault on Truth, came out in 1984. And shortly after that, well, before that, I was fired from the archives. So, and then I was living with Catherine McKinnon in California, and I think she was the first person to tell me, well, now that you have nothing to do, you should think about doing what you love most, which is thinking about animals. Why don't you write a book about animals? And that's how I came to write When Elephants Weep, which, to my surprise, became an international bestseller. I really didn't expect that.
Do elephants weep?
No, they don't. But, in fact, no animal sheds tears of sorrow the way humans do. But all animals feel sorrow.
Hmm.
And all animals suffer, of course.
And on the other side of the coin, do you know of any people who do not like animals?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it's puzzling, actually, because sometimes you meet people who tell you that they adore animals and love them, and love them more than humans, and then they tuck into a steak or, you know, drink their milk or eat eggs, and you see they're using animal products, and you draw that to their attention, and they say, well, I love my food more than I love the living animal. And you can't say much. If somebody says, I don't care how much this animal suffered for me to eat it, there's not much of an argument you can have. But if people tell you, I love animals, I don't want to be cruel to them, and yet I eat them, you're faced with a fundamental contradiction there.
Well, fundamental contradictions are what make life interesting. And life gets interesting right here on the Food Chain Radio program. Today especially because we have with us Jeffrey Mason, who is the author of Beasts, What Animals Can Teach Us About Good and Evil. And we have some very interesting thoughts to bring up in that regard. One of them is, what is the nature of man and beast in nature, out there in the wild? What are we like? What is the nature of man and beast in civilization? How do we change when we civilize ourselves and our animals? And then, of course, the most important thing today, which is most cruel? the beast, or the person. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson. Phone numbers today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080, or on the Food Chain forums at metrofarm.com. Pick up your phone and join us. Away we go.
You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-, 6-, or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
Is anybody out there think that animals are more cruel than people? I wonder. Jeffrey, have you ever run into anybody who thought that animals are more cruel than people?
Oh, sure. I mean, look at the phrase "nature red in tooth and claw." And many people, I've just been speaking about my book on a book tour, and I'm surprised at the number of people in the audience who raise the issue of how cruel animals can be to one another, how cruel it is when they kill each other for food, totally overlooking what we do, and often using cliches like, cats and mice, where in fact it's really not cruelty, even though it may look like that to us, or even orcas. That's my favorite animal right now, because turns out that orcas have never killed another orca in the wild, as far as anyone knows.
Well, that's what I wanted to know, is how would anybody know very much about orcas in the wild?
Well, there are probably 300 or 400 people, researchers, who devote their lives to studying orcas, and I've contacted all the main orca researchers to ask them if they'd ever seen evidence of what looked like lethal violence, and they said no, they never had. And you're right, it doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but we've never seen it. So the presumption is it probably doesn't happen.
So then orcas are not cruel animals.
Well, they're certainly not cruel to one another. However, there is a famous video that some of your viewers may have seen. Michael Krasny raised it with me when I was on his radio show. And that is, you see a group of orcas, highly intelligent, cooperating in isolating a poor baby whale. I think it was a right whale in this case, from its mother, who's grieving horribly and trying to do everything she can to save her baby. And they proceed to kill this baby by ripping out its tongue. That is the part of the animal that they want to eat. And anybody watching this is appalled. I was appalled. Everyone's appalled. And I asked some orca researchers about this. I said, well, since these are such highly intelligent animals, since they have extraordinary empathy for one another, even to the point of perhaps committing suicide when another member dies by beaching, when they go up on the beach. Some that may be suicidal behavior because they don't want to leave members of their own pod, how can they not be aware of the suffering they're causing to this baby whale? And there is no satisfactory answer except to say, well, you know, we often have tongue on our menu. So how do we get that tongue? We have to rip it out of an animal, and we kill animals at, you know, possibly 200 billion animals a year killed for food, and maybe a trillion fish are killed every year for food. So, you know, we're hardly a species to talk about cruelty. And, of course, orcas don't have a choice as we do. We can choose what we're going to eat. Orcas can't. No animal, in fact, in the wild chooses its diet.
Well, orcas can't choose to eat another part of a fish, other they have to go for the baby whale tongue.
Well, yeah,
it seems like kind of a delicacy to me, right?
I agree. It does sound that way, but we don't know. We don't know enough of what it is that the orca is getting out of the tongue that it may require. I doubt it's just because it likes the tongue. You know that orcas have, I mean, the different kinds of orcas have very strict traditions about what they eat. So orcas in the Pacific Northwest, some of them eat fish and salmon and never touch marine mammals, and others never touch fish but only eat marine mammals. And I presume that's, it's cultural, of course.
Kind of like Thanksgiving turkey.
Yeah, but I think it's because they don't want to interfere with one another. They don't want to get into conflict. You're eating my food.
Ah.
So they just decide, okay, we'll eat different food from you, and that way we won't have to interact in any violent way, mm-hmm. which is pretty intelligent.
Can we back up just a little bit? And I have a question that's always puzzled me, and that is, it seems like we all living organisms must kill to eat. See, it seems like we are all either predator or prey. How would you respond to that notion?
Well, it's actually not true, because if you look at mammals, what are there, 4,300 mammals approximately. Of those mammals, 90% are herbivores.
Mm-hmm.
They don't kill any animal to eat. They only eat plants.
And plants are not living things?
Well, sure. Plants are alive. Yeah. Oh, okay. If you take it in that sense, I thought you were talking about eating other animals.
Well, I'm just thinking about all life on Earth.
Yeah.
You know, all life, all living things.
Yeah.
It seems must either eat or must kill to eat. We are either, you know, kind of predator or prey.
Okay. But tell me, let me ask you, do you believe there's a difference in sensibility between a plant and an animal? Do you think a lettuce or a tomato suffers to the same degree that an animal does when it's killed?
I am not certain.
Okay. Do you have any evidence for that? I mean,
you know, I've been in the course of my life very close to a number of plants.
Mm-hmm.
And though I did not learn how to speak with them, I had a sneaking suspicion that there was intelligence of some kind in there. The language I did not know, but I'm pretty darn certain that all of life is sentient to one extent or another, and that I'm just not smart enough to know how to listen to a lot of things.
Yeah. Well, it would be a terrible thought, you know, if we really believed or we discovered that the plants we eat, lettuce and so on, actually suffered, that would be terrible. I'm not aware of it. I haven't seen any evidence that they suffer. I agree with you. I wouldn't use the word sentient, but I think they have they're obviously alive, and they are able to communicate. Trees communicate with one another. I mean, we're just at the beginning of understanding the complexity of plant life.
Let's go to the difference in a world of life. There are predator and prey. Must there always be predator and prey? Must some always?
No, there are lots of animals that that are neither predator nor prey. I mean, just look at hippopotamus, for example, they're pure vegetarians, but no animal's going to attack them because they're so powerful. Giraffes, no animal will attack a full-grown giraffe. Or, of course, an elephant is the main example. Elephants are pure vegans. They don't eat any animal product. They don't attack other animals unless they're defending themselves.
Mm-hmm. And but what about the bacteria that attack the elephants?
Yeah, okay.
I mean, it seems like everything, you know, has a predator. The biggest among us, you know, the giant elephants have little tiny things that attack them as well, and they must defend them.
Generally, don't kill them or don't cause them horrendous suffering. I mean, see, I think we have to be concerned with the kind of suffering we can understand. And there's no reason not to believe that every human being is capable of understanding the pain and the suffering that a pig experiences when you slit the pig's throat. I mean, you cannot claim that that animal is not suffering horrendously.
Okay, when we're going to take a quick break, Jeffrey, but when we come back, I'd like to pick up suffering and slaughter and what it takes, you know, to get by in this world for both of us, both animals and people. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson here with Jeffrey Mason. He's the author of Beasts, What Animals Can Teach Us About the Origins of Good and Evil. Curious to know what you think. Do you think, which one do you think is most cruel, animals or people? Most people, it seems, think animals are the least cruel and we are the most cruel. What do you think? Right back. So my father-in-law tells a story of his grandparents homesteading out in the prairies of Montana. And one night the wolves came and chased away the horses. And his grandfather then had to walk 125 miles into South Dakota to retrieve the horses, who ran home, not liking wolves or something. And thus, grandmother had to spend that time alone in that sod-busting house out in the prairie. And the wolves came at night and surrounded her. And the only thing she really had to defend herself was an iron skillet and a spoon with which she made noise and chased the wolves away. Now, I suppose that grandmother hunkered down at night in that sod-busting house with little or no protection, was thinking that those wolves were up to no good, cruel animals. But Jeffrey Mason in Beasts writes, a pack of wolves cannot be said to be vicious when there is a productive endpoint to their behavior. Well, I guess they had a productive endpoint, but Grandma didn't think so. What does Jeffrey have to say about that?
Well, actually, in the entire 20th century, there were only two or three deaths by wolves. So wolves don't normally attack humans. It may be somewhat different in Russia, though it's hard to disentangle what's myth from what's reality. But certainly in the United States, there have been almost no deaths by wolves in hundreds of years. So our fear of them is just overblown. They're not predators on human. We're not part of their diet. The first thing a wolf does, I mean, wolf researchers would give anything to even glimpse a wolf. Usually the minute they see a human, they race away. You know, it's interesting in Norway, where the wolf has been extinct for several hundred years, they had a survey of the population. What are you most afraid of? And 25% of people said, I'm most afraid of wolves. Mm-hmm. So in fact, there are no wolves at all in Norway. So in other words, we ascribe these qualities to them. Now, obviously, if somebody's completely alone and they see a wolf, it might make sense to be frightened, but it's very unlikely that that wolf would attack them. It's a little bit different with a cougar, but even cougars, how many deaths are there by cougars?
So we people have this probably unreasonable fear of certain predators, but Having been up in the fringes of Yellowstone Park here a year or so ago and staying, the people we were staying with, we asked if there were any wolves around, and they said, oh, sure, they're right up there on the hillside. You can just go up there, and you'll see them and hear them. So we went up the road a little bit and the glass of wine in the dusk, and we sat there and waited for the wolves to show up. And though we didn't see them, we heard them. And they have this most frightening howl when they go out on a rip at night. And when they started howling, all of the cows in the entire valley started moo. And so I suspect that they do have a way of inspiring fear. But we do seem to be unreasonably fearful of predators. Now, do these predators kill wantonly?
No, I think all animals in the wild kill for food exclusively. They don't kill for fun. They're not like, USA hunters go out hunting for bear. They don't do that. I mean, look at bears. I don't know if you saw the film Grizzly Man, but you had this slightly loopy man, Timothy Treadwell, who went out for 13 years or 14 years in the wilderness of Alaska meeting grizzly bears during the summer. And they tolerated him. He was there. He would get so close to them that he could put his finger on their nose and act like they were teddy bears. And they would look at him like, what's going on with this guy? But they left him alone for 14 years. And then, unfortunately, he encountered a bear that didn't know him at all and was very hungry. And it was the beginning of winter, and he was eaten. But, you know, by and large, again, bears, how many deaths by bears are there every year in the United States? A couple. How many bears do we kill every year? Oh, maybe 40,000.
Well, before we go to the fact that we kill these critters, I have in my hand here a story about a bear up in Montana. And I kind of tune into these things because I'm from Montana and I've seen these stories come and go over the years. Here's a bear near Great Falls, a female grizzly that killed 70 sheep at one time. Goes through the pasture and kills all the sheep. Of course, you can't eat all those sheep, so why would you kill all the sheep if not doing it for fun?
Well, she wasn't doing it for fun. I think, you know, they call that surplus killing, you know, killing more than you need. And it's not something that you find in nature. So what you had here was an artificial situation. Bears in their ordinary environment do not encounter animals that are confined like that. The animal that a bear is chasing runs away. They don't have occasion to kill 70 at a time. You see this with foxes. You know, that's where we get the expression, the fox in the hen house.
Mm-hmm.
You know, suddenly they're killing 20, 30 chickens. What goes through their mind is impossible to say, oh, my God, you know, suddenly there's all this food. I better eat as much as I can. I better kill it and cache it and put it away for later. I mean, it's disturbing the natural order because they don't encounter this in their everyday existence.
And
so we've created a condition that they're not exposed to normally.
Yeah, and I think if mankind has done one thing really well, it's created an unnatural situation. That fair enough?
Yes, absolutely.
Take us back to the beginnings of agriculture. What were we like before agriculture?
Well,
when things really unnatural?
Yeah. We're talking about 10,000 years ago, which is the beginning of agriculture and, coincidentally, the beginning of the domestication of animals. So except for the dog, you didn't have any animal domesticated before 10,000 years. So we were living as hunter-gatherers for most of our entire evolutionary history as a modern species, which goes back about 50,000 years.
Were we kind of like animals then?
Exactly. We were very much like another animal. We were hardly different. We weren't cruel in the way we are today. We didn't have hierarchy. We didn't have despotism. We had no kings. We didn't have masters. We had no slavery. We had no warfare. We didn't even have greed. So we were small bands of hunter-gatherers who would move from place to place, subsisting mostly on roots and fruits and berries and plant food, occasionally supplemented by an animal that we could kill. But since it was dangerous to go hunting, it was not something we did constantly. We had to be very cautious about how we did it. So we were very much like other apex predators. In fact, it's not even clear we were an apex predator at that point. We were probably not the supreme predator, not until we had weapons, which came later. But when we were trying to kill with rocks or our bare hands or even primitive spears, we weren't very successful at it.
We're going to have to take a quick break, Jeffrey. But when we come back, I do want to pick up that primitive man and the nature of him and how civilization changed the nature of man and animal. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Jeffrey Mason. He's the author of Beasts, What Animals Can Teach Us About the Origins of Good and Evil. What do you think about that? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Consider this. I always thought, you know, the apogee of American civilization was after was on the high prairies of the American West, after the horse and before the white man. That gave the indigenous peoples of the high prairie the means by which they could chase down buffalo, they could fly across the prairie on those beautiful horses. What freedom! And yet they were the most warlike people I've ever heard of, because that's what they did. They fought with each other. They raided each other's villages. They stole each other's horses and their women, and they beat each other over the head with stone clubs and bows and arrows and took scalps and whatnot. But somehow that doesn't quite square with Jeffrey's notion of the noble savage. Jeffrey?
Well, no, these were no longer hunter-gatherers. That's the problem. You're talking about something that had been introduced. I mean, once the domestication of animals came in, like the horse or any other animal, you had possessions. You had private property. You had people who had more than others, or people who wanted more than they had. And so people went to war and started killing. They didn't do that before. They simply walked away. So that was the, you're talking of something that happened after 10,000 years ago. So there was this fundamental change, you see, in with agriculture and with the domestication of animals. Our whole species began slowly to change. Now, warfare didn't come in for a couple thousand years after the advent of agriculture and animal domestication, but I think the ground was laid for it. You had bigger populations. You had the necessity of trying to feed more people, and you looked across the valley and saw a population that was smaller and doing better, and you said, well, why shouldn't we take their land? So none of this ever happened before. It was a whole new ball game, and not a good one.
Not a good one. You know, one of the great messings around that I read in your book, Beasts, was when Jane Goodall started feeding chimpanzees bananas.
That's right, yeah. I mean, she would look back on it now, or she does look back on it now, and think, I wonder if I created the conditions for chimpanzees to go what looked very much like human war.
Tell us what happened there.
That's what happened. They began, one tribe decided they wanted to totally eradicate another tribe, and nobody had ever seen anything like this in any animal, and I talk a lot in my book about genocide and how it's unique to humans, and people say, yeah, well, what about that? What about the chimpanzees? And so I devote a lot of...
So what happened when the chimpanzees started getting the bananas?
Well, they became greedy, and they wanted more, and they didn't want others to get what they could get so easily. And so a number of males decided to go hunting and try and eradicate another chimpanzee group, which they more or less did. And she was appalled by it, wrote about it. And since then, it's been a matter of contention in anthropologists and people who study primates, primatologists, you have a book like Demonic Males by Richard Wrangham from Harvard, which argues we're just chimpanzees, we're part of that world, and then there are others who say, no, we're more like bonobos who don't go to war, who don't hunt any other animal, don't kill each other, and it's still very much up in the air. I obviously come down on the side of the bonobos. By the way, I will be talking about all this in Santa Cruz on Monday at Bookshop at 7 o'clock. So, if anybody wants to pursue this, I'll be there to talk about it.
Good. And I'd like to pursue it one more notch along the way here. Which is the most efficient killer, people or animals?
What do you mean by efficient?
Well, least cruel.
Oh, least cruel.
Yeah.
Well, I'd have to say that animals are the concept of cruelty doesn't exist in the animal world. They're not aware that they're causing suffering, with the possible exception of the orca. We certainly know it. And if you watch the big cats do a kill, it's over in seconds. The animal hardly has a chance to realize it's been killed. Mm-hmm. Whereas, we raise animals to kill them. And no matter how much we try and disguise that, I think that every animal knows what is in store for them, especially when they're being led to slaughter. And this is why you hear pigs, for example, squealing and what we would regard as screaming, actually, as they approach the slaughterhouse.
Have you ever read the work of Dr. Temple Grandin?
Yes, I have, yes.
Who is working with the animal husbandry industry to make that process much less cruel. And it seems to me that her work has led to, the slaughtering of animals in a way that is much less cruel than that of a wild animal jumping on an animal's back and strangling it to death.
Well, I disagree entirely, because what Temple Grandin is doing is simply being a shill for the industry. She's helping them.
Okay, we have to hold animals. That. We've got to pick up a quick break. And when we come back, I have the big question for you. And it is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, do stay tuned. So much to talk about and so little time to talk about it in, with Jeffrey Mason, the author of Beasts, the What Animals Can Teach Us About the Origins of Good and Evil. What a fun read. What an interesting read. What a challenging read. Jeffrey, the good book tells us to be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on earth. Many would say that this dominion means that we must be responsible for all that is under our supervision and that we've done a very bad job. Do you think the good Lord gave the job to the wrong organism?
That's a good question. There's a fantastic book by Matthew Scully, who was Bush's speechwriter. I don't hold that entirely against him, because he redeemed himself by writing the book Dominion, in which he looks at exactly that question, and he comes out very much on the side of animals. He's a vegan, and unlike Temple Grandin, he doesn't want these animals to die under any circumstances, whether it's a gentle death or a brutal death. He just doesn't want them to die because, as he points out, we don't need to eat these animals to survive. They do. That's the difference. The lion is what we call an obligate carnivore. That is, he's obliged to eat other animals to survive. His digestion won't permit him to live off plants, but ours does. And humans can thrive, in fact, on eating only plants. It's better for our health. It's better for the planet, and of course it's better for the animals because they don't get eaten. So he makes that argument very beautifully. It's an extraordinary book. I highly recommend it.
So do you think the good Lord assigned this job on the wrong organism? Were people the wrong people to give the job to, all this dominion business, this stewardship?
Well,
would it have been given to, like, elephants or something?
Yeah, absolutely. Elephants, you know, I used to be a Sanskrit scholar, and I spent a lot of time in India. And they have these legends. Well, they're stories. I'm not sure if they're real or not, but they claim that elephants make extraordinary babysitters, that they would, in ancient India, they would draw a circle. They would put the baby inside the circle, and they would put an elephant in there, and they tell the elephant, don't let the baby leave the circle. And so the baby would crawl out, and the elephant would pull it back with its trunk very gently and keep it. Now, I don't know if that's true. I've never actually seen that. But I believe it's possible. Elephants have extraordinary empathy, especially for one another. They're just so many amazing elephants.
Until they get into the mature berries.
Pardon?
Until they get into fermented berries.
That's right. Yeah, well, just like us. You know, it's not good for us to eat to drink fermented berries.
Well, what fun. What are you going to do next, Jeffrey?
Well, you know, this is my 29th book. And I'm 73 years old. I think I deserve a little rest, but I'm sure it's not going to be very long.
Okay, well, good for you. Now, let me ask you this. Really, what do you think? Do you think that man is irredeemably cruel?
Well, I think man is cruel. I don't think it's irredeemable. And that's, at the end of my book, I put out the hope that we can change. I'm really heartened. I just arrived here from New Zealand. I'm heartened by seeing the number of vegetarian and vegan restaurants that are sprouting up everywhere. If you open today's New York Times, you'll read a fantastic article about why.
There you are. We're out of time. But Jeffrey Mason, thank you so much. And thank you, all you vegans out there, for being good. This has been The Food Chain.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.